No, we were in Nicaragua in November. We went to northern Costa Rica to plant the cocoa. And Vanessa wanted to do this in Nicaragua. We didn't get as far north as Managua, but we took kind of a long bus tour. This is like Nicaragua, and there's a beautiful little colony, a city called Granada, which was the Spanish capital of the 1540. But it's extremely poor. And how long it takes you to pass from Nicaragua and customs, because you get a bit close, what's going in, what's going out, is a function of how big a bribe the tour company was to pay the customs officials there. So this was during the height of the Ebola, and if you didn't pay the bribe, you also all had to debus and get tested for Ebola, which is basically taking the temperature.
I think she's going
to. You know, what was amazing was...
All rise. State of Washington Court of Appeals Division 1 is now in session. The Honorable Michael Spearman presiding.
Good morning. Be seated, everyone. First case, State of Washington versus Ronald Brown. The party's ready to go forward.
Yes. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Maureen Sear. I represent Ronald Brown. And I would like to inform the court that Mr. Brown has a couple family members that are present in the audience today. And I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, several errors occurred in this case. First, Mr. Brown's constitutional right to notice was violated when the jury was instructed on alternative means of committing the crimes of first-degree robbery and first-degree kidnapping that were not charged in the information. Those convictions must be reversed. In addition, Mr. Brown's constitutional right to be free from double jeopardy was violated when separate convictions were entered for second-degree assault, where those assaults were an integral part of both the kidnappings and the robberies, and therefore constituted the same offense for double jeopardy purposes. And the second-degree assault convictions must be vacated. And in addition, the state did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Brown was guilty of first-degree robbery because it did not prove either that he personally took property or that he aided or encouraged purposely aided others in taking property. And that the jury was encouraged to enter a verdict for first-degree robbery erroneously, in addition by the prosecutor's improper argument and closing argument that Mr. Brown could be liable for the robberies because he participated in the other crimes. Unless the court directs me otherwise, I believe the first issue is adequately presented in the briefing. And I did want to then focus on the other two issues. As I stated, the two assaults merged into the robberies and the kidnappings because they were an integral part of those two crimes.
Before you begin on that, I do have a question about the robbery instruction. I think the state is arguing that there's invited error because the defense counsel in that case provided an instruction that I believe was identical to the state's instruction with
yes.
the exception of reference to accomplice liability.
Yes.
Correct? Okay. And the court gave the instruction offered by the state. Is that correct?
I'm not sure exactly which one was provided to the jury, but my understanding is that they were identical except for the accomplice liability language, so I don't think it really, I'm not sure it matters.
Well, I guess my question was, if in fact it was the instruction that the state offered that was given, does the invited error doctrine still apply if the instruction offered by the defendant was not the one that was given?
Perhaps not. I mean, the invited error doctrine says that a defendant cannot invite an error and then benefit from it on appeal, It sounds like the court would have given the state's instruction if the defendant had not offered one. I think that I've my understanding of the case law, though, is that sometimes invited error has been found when the trial court gives an instruction that is identical to one that was offered by the defense.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
In terms of the assaults merging into the robberies and the kidnappings, the state concedes that because the assault was based on the use of the firearms during the event, unless it created some kind of separate injury, those assaults would merge into the kidnappings and the robberies. The trial court, the jury was not instructed on what the assaults were, and just basically was given a generic to convict instruction regarding the assaults. And the prosecutor argued in closing that the assaults occurred throughout the entire event when some of the participants were displaying firearms. And there was no jury finding that the assault was somehow separate from the robberies and the kidnappings. However, at sentencing, the trial court made a finding on its own that the assault was separate when Mr. Fordham was exiting the house and pointed his gun at the Munsons and told them that they should not go to the police. That's improper. If it is a separate offense.
I thought the state argued that as well. They did not argue that.
I believe they did. And in the appeal, the state is also arguing that was the assault. That is not what the state argued below. No, the state argued in closing that the assaults occurred throughout the events. And if indeed this is a separate offense, and because this is a double jeopardy issue, the issue is whether or not the assaults are a separate offense. If it is a separate offense, then the state bears the burden to prove the elements of that offense beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury. In other words, the jury must make a finding that this is a separate offense, and there is no jury finding to that effect. Therefore, as the state argued below, the assaults were part of the ongoing events and therefore must be merged into the robberies and the kidnappings. Any ambiguity in the jury verdict must be resolved in Mr. Brown's favor in addition. And finally, the state did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Brown was guilty of first-degree robbery. There's no evidence at all that Mr. Brown took any property. In order to convict him of first-degree robbery, the state bore the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, therefore, that he was guilty as an accomplice. To prove accomplice liability, the state must prove not only that a person was present and aware of the crime that it was occurring, and here the crime for purposes of accomplice liability is the robbery and not any other crime.
Isn't there significant evidence that Mr. Brown had control over, was the leader of this group of folks that went to the Munson's home?
I think there's some evidence that he was the leader, but there's no evidence at all that he encouraged or abetted or aided the robberies.
Wasn't he able to stop the one of the other men in the house from taking the ring from Mr. Munson?
Simply because a defendant might be able to stop a crime that's occurring does not mean he can be guilty of that crime. A person has no obligation to, I believe, to stop a crime in progress. Again, accomplice liability requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the person aided or encouraged the commission of the crime.
It does show some control, though, does it not, over...
Some control, but I don't think that means he's liable for every single thing that anybody else did during the event.
He only has to be liable for one of those takings, though, doesn't he?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
The state must prove that he had the purpose to aid or abet the robbery and not any other crime that was committed. Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Seth Fine, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for Snohomish County, representing the respondent of the State of Washington. I'd like to start with a question that Judge Spearman asked with regard to the invited error. And first of all, the judge gave the state's version of the robbery instruction rather than the defense version. The defense version, however, incorporated the same error under case law an invited error, it is not necessary that the invited instruction be exactly the same as what was proposed. It is only necessary that it incorporate the same error, which in this case it did. And if the court wishes, I can provide additional authority on that point. So, and that doesn't eliminate the issue entirely, but it shifts it onto the grounds of ineffective assistance of counsel. As to the robbery, the question is not whether the state can prove harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt, but whether the defense can show a reasonable possibility, or excuse me, a reasonable probability that the error affected the verdict. In this case, the uncharged alternative is inflicting bodily harm. The charged alternative is, among other things, being armed with a deadly weapon. The bodily harm at issue was inflicted with a deadly weapon. There is no way a reasonable jury could find the bodily harm alternative without also finding the deadly weapon alternative. So under the reasonable probability test, or indeed under the proof beyond a reasonable doubt test, that error is harmless. I'd like to talk then about the sufficiency of evidence as to the robbery. That's the one error asserted that would entirely preclude retrial if this court agreed that the error had occurred. And the first question that needs to be asked is, what is the mental state for accomplice liability? The answer in the statute is that the person must know that their actions promote or facilitate the commission of a crime, not that they intend that. The statute says knowing, and the Supreme Court has acknowledged that the mental state of the crime is knowledge. So the question is there evidence that the defendant either encouraged or assisted the commission of the crime, knowing that his actions would facilitate the commission of robbery, since that's what we're talking about here? The answer is yes, there was evidence that he was in control of this invasion. There was evidence that, you know, a retaliation of this nature would normally not be limited to recovering the property taken, but would include taking other property. There was evidence that Mr. Brown controlled the situation by monitoring the actions of the two victims, Mr. and Ms. Monson, you know, ensuring that they stayed in place, deciding when and where they would be entitled to move within the house. And there is evidence that he knew that all of these actions would promote and facilitate the commission of the crimes, which were happening around him and of which he was fully aware. So as to that issue, the question is, could a reasonable jury find that those elements were proved? And the answer is yes, there is ample evidence as to guilt of first-degree robbery. As to the merger of the assault, possibly the key question here is, does there have to be a specific finding by the jury of a separate and distinct offense? You know, counsel says that there is, and says that there must be such, and if that position is correct, then in this case there was not. Case law, however, doesn't set out that requirement. If you look at the Freeman case, which I cited in my brief, that's an analysis by the court as to whether the offenses were separate and distinct, not necessarily a finding by the jury. As we've pointed out in our brief, there was evidence, you know, strong evidence of an assault after the crimes were committed, assault after, as the perpetrators were leaving the building, and one which is not part of the robbery, was not committed in order to maintain possession of the property, but in order to discourage the victims from reporting the crime to police.
How was it argued to the jury?
It was argued to the jury as both assaults during the, you know, during the commission of the robberies and kidnapping, as well as this assault that occurred at the end of those crimes.
So when the prosecutor argued the case below, he drew no distinction between the assaults that he was asking the jury to find the defendant guilty of assault versus assaults that were intermingled with the kidnapping and robbery.
Yeah. She did not. That is correct.
If we were, so I want to be clear. The state's position is we're reviewing the trial court's decision that there was no merger then as opposed to the jury finding?
That's correct. Yeah.
And what would be the standard of review of that?
The standard of review, since this, since this is a factual determination by the court, the standard of review should be substantial evidence. Again, if the question is, did the jury verdict on its face show the commission of a separate act, the answer would have to be no. And if that is the question, then the argument that the prosecutor made to the jury is significant. If that is not the issue and it's a matter to be decided by the court, then the argument presented to the jury is not significant, or at least not dispositive. One other point with regard to the separate offenses. So the argument has been raised that if the conviction for the separate assaults is based on this assault at the end, that the state has to prove that the defendant was specifically an accomplice to that assault, that he encouraged or knowingly facilitated commission of that particular act. And in regards to this, the state Friday submitted a statement of additional authority citing the case of In re Sarasad. And the point of that case, insofar as it's relevant here, is when the crime, when the statute and the jury instruction says facilitate the commission of the crime, it means the generic crime, not the specific crime. For example, a person who encourages and facilitates a second-degree robbery can be convicted of first-degree robbery. And similarly, a person who facilitates a second-degree assault is at risk if there are additional acts of second-degree assault that he doesn't, that he didn't anticipate, just as he is at risk if there is a more severe robbery than he anticipated. So the facilitating the specific act rule is not, in fact, the standard. The standard is, did the defendant facilitate an assault? The answer is, he did, and he is thereby liable as an accomplice to four additional assaults committed in the same course of events. To that limited extent, the in for a penny, in for a pound rule does continue to apply. So for those reasons, the trial court properly found that there was no merger, properly entered judgment on the second-degree assaults, as well as the other crimes found by the jury. And as to the other issues, I believe they're adequately addressed in my brief, and the judgment and sentence should be affirmed as to all counts.
Thank you.
It is true that for accomplice liability, the state bears the burden to prove the defendant knew his actions were facilitating the crime, and that knowledge is one of the elements. But it's also true that the state must prove more than mere knowledge. And State v. Rotuno, a case we cited in our brief, the Washington Supreme Court explicitly stated, this court has repeatedly stated that one's presence at the commission of a crime, even coupled with the knowledge that one's presence would aid in the commission of the crime, will not subject an accused to accomplice liability. To prove that one present is an aider, it must be established that one is ready to assist in the commission of the crime. It must be shown that the defendant had a purpose to aid or assist in the crime. So merely because one, if one has agreed to participate in a particular crime, that person may not also be liable as an accomplice to an additional different crime unless the person acted with a purpose to aid that crime. And in regard to the court's finding in regard to the assault, I think the case law states that there must be a jury finding to support the conclusion that an assault was separate from a robbery or kidnapping. I direct the court to review closely State v. Keir, which came out of the Washington Supreme Court a few years after Freeman. In that case, there were two victims of a robbery and an assault, second-degree assault. the jury was not instructed, nor did it make a finding in regard to who was the victim of the assault. And even though the prosecutor argued in closing that the victim of the assault was different from the victim of the robbery, the Supreme Court said that's not enough. There must be a jury finding that this was a separate offense, that there was a separate victim of the assault in order for there to be separate offenses. Again, as a double jeopardy issue, Mr. Brown can be convicted of a separate offense only if the state proves the elements of that offense beyond a reasonable doubt. There must be a jury finding in that regard. And again, the court's finding that this was a separate offense is based on the court's erroneous view of what robbery is. The court explicitly found that the robbery was terminated when, at the moment, the property was taken. But instead, it's clear in Washington that robbery is an ongoing offense that is not completed until the robber effectuates an escape. And Mr. Fordham's action of pointing the gun at the Munsons as he was leaving the house was in order to help the robbers effectuate an escape, and therefore was part of the robbery and merged into the robbery. Thank you.